Welcome to episode 5 of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education. And how about number 16?
How about the Zooniverse?
Zooniverse. Okay. We'll go for the Zooniverse.
I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together we are the hosts of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
So let's get started. So actually, as part of the introduction, there's a few things that I wanted to mention. It's probably handy to have the date for people. So it's March 12th on a Thursday. And normally our plan is to have these podcasts and the blogs out on Sundays. Mm-hmm. So that would not be normally available until the 15th. And then apart from that, I guess that's all there is. So we start as usual with our blog entries. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll have to mention, we had kind of a mess up where we got confused about which blog entries we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I haven't gone back through the old podcasts yet to figure out exactly when we started to switch.
Yes.
So that should not affect yours.
No, right? It won't affect
so
mine.
So we'll do yours, but when we get to mine, we'll go over what's happening a bit.
Okay. More. Sounds good.
So your blog, how do we learn?
So it all started with actually Patrick and his Jodcast. And I think I will have Patrick start with what he listened to.
Well, so, I mean, I was thinking about something very specific. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the Jodcast. I think it was the Jodcast. Mm-hmm. This is a while ago since we talked about this.
Yeah.
Almost a week.
I'm teasing.
And one of the persons being interviewed, he was one of the founders of the Zooniverse website, or the founder, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and so it's one of the founders.
You have his name.
And, yes, I do. And his name is Dr. Chris Lintott.
Lintott, okay. And there was one comment he made that was really fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And it was I don't know if it was the initial project, but one of the Zooniverse projects was about, I think it was the classification of galaxies.
Planet. I thought it was Planet Hunters.
Was it?
That's the one you mentioned to me.
Okay. Yes, yes, that's right. It was Planet Hunters. So it was not the first one, because I think the galaxy classification was the very first one of those. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, so the Zooniverse is a website that was set up to basically be a place where many different projects can get started, and it's all about citizen science.
Right, but it started as a way of promoting amateur astronomy students and giving them, or people who are interested in astronomy, giving them an outlet and getting them involved.
Right. Although, I mean, I think it was both sides. I think it also the researchers had a need.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
The original one, mm-hmm. they had a humongous number of images of galaxies, I mm-hmm. think from Hubble, that needed to be classified, and there was not a good computer system for doing the classification, not one that was mm-hmm. working as well as people, at least at the time. And so they made them available on the website. Anyway, but the Planet Hunters is one of those projects, one mm-hmm. of the ones that came across along later. And he said that it was a popular project, and it was unexpected because basically you're looking at light curves, I think, from the Kepler observatory. I'm not sure, the satellite. Anyway, basically you're looking at light curves from stars. Mm-hmm. And they have dips in them and small raises because of planets passing in front of them. And so people had to just look at graphs and make a decision as to whether this should be checked out for a planet possibly passing in front of it. And he said this was really unexpected because you're just staring at graphs.
Right.
And, you know, I thought maybe that's not unexpected. Maybe, you know, there are certain types of data that that's the best way to understand them. And so naturally people will want to do, you know, that type of work.
Right.
I don't know. I stare at graphs all day long. That's part of my work in science has to do with graphing different properties against each other and seeing the correlations. But then you thought you got a really different take on it.
Right. So Patrick comes out and he goes, well, you know, Dr. Lintott, he says that people just dig into graphs, you know, and graphs are just intuitive. Everybody can figure out a graph. So that was your kind of start into our discussion about how do students learn to read graphs.
Right.
And that. And, you know, when I started to think about working with students in school and how we kind of build up to how we attack graphs and get our data and analyze our data using graphs, I think it's a lot more about practice, and gaining experience with making graphs and talking about them and analyzing them and doing it in small groups and in a larger group so that we start to see what the graph is telling us, because sometimes in isolation we only see the data in a certain way.
So I want to put you on the spot and have you say yes or no, because this was a real point of contention, which you kept saying and then saying, no, that's not what I mean. Okay, but you basically made a comment that there's a requirement for communication between people.
Yes.
And I said,
well,
no.
Not necessarily between people, but
see, you're saying yes and then no.
So it's not the communication between.
You know where that people like you end up? It's called limbo. It's not quite hell, but it's not heaven either. You have to either choose a side.
Okay. So here's the thing. I went on to Zooniverse right after the discussion, and I checked out that site. Right. And what I realized is, yeah, those people were looking at graphs and digging into graphs, but before they even start looking at graphs and getting the information they're supposed to get, they go through this tutorial that walks them through things to look for, trends to see for certain conditions. And I thought, well, that's exactly what we're doing in class, but we're doing it in a discussion
with like you're doing in class.
Students so that we are getting that practice experience in what the data is telling us, and then being able to verbalize what that data is. And in the website, it does a very similar thing with the tutorial. And then you start digging into those graphs that you were given a tutorial on.
Fine. In that case, Mrs. Eighth Grade Teacher, I'll just replace you with an interactive web page in the front of the class.
I tried that this week.
Actually, that was not my point. I mean, see, I keep coming back. See, I don't have a problem with the whole tutorial thing, right? Mm-hmm. It just, what really didn't seem right to me is that there's a need for communication between people, right? And I know you see that as a minor thing of the whole thing, but to me, that's like an interesting question. Do people naturally need that, or is it there's something about certain types of data that it's very easy to understand what's happening if you look at a graph, and something else it's much more easy to look at an equation, and something else it's easier to read a description.
Right.
You know, and of course you get a full understanding from everything, but I just don't know. I mean, you might be right about the communication thing and about how complicated it is, but
I think
I mean, do you think, that's what I'm wondering is, you know, this will not be settled until we can find out whether people on there that got so fascinated with Planet Hunter actually got fascinated only because they also had other people to talk to.
Right. Yeah. And they wouldn't be
fascinated by the grass, right?
And my point was, if these are people who are, you know, excited and passionate about looking for planets and looking through the data to see if they can find it for themselves, they probably know many other people that are excited and passionate in that way,
mm-hmm.
Through clubs, associations, or whatever. I think that...
you have to admit that at, you know, eighth grade and through high school, there's a very strong anti-intellectual kind of mindset in the U.S. that, you know, Tom Sawyer attitude, right? And that education is not really needed. And, you know, you have plenty of, like, geeky kids that learn incredible stuff. And, yeah, I understand there's some communication involved there. But I have a feeling that a lot of what you see as inability on the part of students is really the fact that they're being forced to be in class. They're not that interested. And they don't want to put out the effort. So it looks like they really can't figure anything else, anything out. And I mean, one of the things that you keep coming back about and that other teachers do when you talk to them about is having to reteach stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And things like, well, you've got to reteach math stuff when you hit mathematical problems in science because they didn't get it in math class and graphs and things like that. And it's like, well, you know, maybe they did, but they just don't want to put the effort to...
Right. They learned it in isolation and they didn't have a purpose behind what that formula or what that graph could do for them.
Right. Yeah. And if you put them in a situation like your makerspace,
mm-hmm.
when then suddenly they have to figure something out, suddenly it comes to them.
Right.
And they refigure it out maybe themselves, or maybe they can't themselves and it requires communication, which is... So,
just as a fun add-on to this discussion is after we talked about this, I went into Zooniverse and I looked for projects.
Was that before or after you gave me the black eye?
After I gave you the black eye.
Uh-huh, okay.
I went on to Zooniverse and I checked for projects that for areas that we were covering right now. And I tried it out for the first time in class this week. And
you tried it with your kids?
So I did. I used it as my enrichment piece.
Very
and
cool.
And so for the students that finished, I was like, hey, how about you go on Zooniverse and you go into, and for our work, we were looking at kelp forests and plankton.
So they actually did some...
They did that.
Like, is it a classification? I remember seeing you practice that.
Yeah, you identify where the kelp forests are. And
so kind of describe what this project is.
So kelp forests, it's set up to help a researcher identify where the kelp forests are along the coast of California. And they have all of these pictures that were taken along the coast of California and... that go back into the interior, and your job is to go in and look at these pictures and either move on, as in there's nothing in the picture that you can use for kelp forests, or mark it as cloudy, or you actually highlight the kelp forests that you see in the image. You know, and you have a tutorial helping you identify good images, bad images that should be deleted, or, you know.
And the way I understand this is that, so you circle, if you do see where there's a kelp forest, you circle it on this
with
image,
your mouse, yeah.
And then the researcher then will have a stack of, oh, these images don't even bother looking.
Right.
These people circled stuff.
Right.
So check those out.
Exactly.
So it's not directly creating the data.
No.
As much as creating...
where to look.
Potential data.
Right.
For the researchers that then go through the images to see what you've
done. Images that are worth taking your time to look at.
Yeah. And but so, it's but it might end up as real data because you've actually
highlighted
it. And if the researcher, I mean, he can look through that pretty quick, and it seemed like it was not too difficult to do.
No, the highlighting was really easy. Yeah. You could get a nice tight fit around the kelp forest and that.
I mean, I know if I was a researcher, I mean, I'm in situations like this all the time with grad students and stuff. And, you know, I look at the data, and if there are just tons of data, which I deal with this type of stuff all the time, just, you know, dozens of videos that we had to go through of cilia beating and transport in airway tissues. You know, I look when the students did, and I check every one, and if it looks good enough, I'm like, okay, good. That's it. This is the data. Because it's such a monumental task to do image analysis.
Right.
Do you know if those images were, are they airplane or satellite?
They're, you know, I'm not sure. I can check while we're talking.
And do you remember, like, what the official name of the project is? It's in the Zooniverse.
Yeah, and it's under Nature, and you go down, it's called Discovering Floating Force.
Okay,
so that's the one that we're talking about. And
oh, very cool.
Yeah, so it gives you a total. So there's 1,585,000 classifications, and there's 406,700 and some odd images to complete, and the users that have been on there is over 4,000.
So that's
57.
But actually, those are not images to complete. Those are completed ones.
Or sorry, completed images. Pardon me.
And so the number of classifications.
And these are pictures from space, so they must be satellites.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And so what they do is they get these images, and some of the images are really handy and useful. Some are clouded, so. And some are over land, so you have to skip them.
Right.
And you have to choose whether you're going to take the image or go on to the next image.
Very
so
cool.
My students were doing it, and they liked it. And it's a kind of a quick activity that they could do when they finished up their project.
Right.
A more challenging one that they were also working at was dive into the planktonic world, and it looks at plankton. And you go into a tutorial which teaches you how to measure plankton.
Right.
And then identify it.
Right.
And it's very challenging, but then as you go through the tutorial, they say, oh, don't worry about it, because your images or the information that you collect is cross-referenced with five or more other people who are doing the very same thing.
Right.
So they're picking out what they see as common,
right,
you know, common identifications.
Gotcha.
So,
right. So if something's very difficult, probably there won't be a good correlation between different people.
Right.
But if something can really be, there's something about the human brain that identifies this correctly.
Right.
Then everybody will probably identify it in the same way. And so that works.
Right.
And that cross-correlates. Correlates, rather.
Exactly. So the students really enjoyed it, but they've also gone on to look for other things. So one of the students came in today that was done with her project. She had a big planets t-shirt on.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, wow, do you know, are you finished with your project? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, go on to Zooniverse, check out the Planet Hunter. And she was so excited because they had just gone to the Moorhead Planetarium and they had just got the t-shirt.
Cool.
And she was excited about digging into it. So really nice enrichment that you can offer students, and those students that get excited are really invested in it.
Well, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
So my blogs, so normally we put out the podcast on the same day that I have to put out one of my blogs.
Right.
And I think, but we started on week 3 of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant that I was done. And then somehow we started to discuss my latest blog, which I had done early.
Right.
So we're going to double up a little bit this time, mm-hmm. but it's going to be... So last time we talked about my blog entry about scientific names. Mm-hmm. Really, we should be talking about it this time.
Right, right.
So do you have any kind of idea? That kind of... The scientific names thing kind of went along with our discussion about the graphing.
Right, it right? did.
This idea that mm-hmm. there are some things that just seem to work well. Mm-hmm. And when you're used to studying in a certain area, you gravitate towards a particular system that seems to work well. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not... There's a reason people use scientific names for some animals and not right. others. And, you know, that can be seen very easily in the fact that in the literature, in the scientific literature, some animals are always referred to by their scientific names. And others, even though the scientific name is the important thing, people still refer to them
right.
by their common names. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I since we talked about it already, some... I don't know how much we want to say. My next one I haven't written yet, so I won't say too much. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should leave that for future plans.
Okay.
So that makes more sense, I guess.
Okay. So
topics of interest.
Okay. So I have a few topics of interest for myself this
week. You go ahead.
I have... a STEM solar car competition coming up, and yay, we had sun today, and we also have 5 cars that are running. Maybe not all well, but they're running, and that's always exciting to get everything hooked up and see the car move.
So the kids had the cars outside and...
Right.
Mm-hmm. And solar rays were actually powering them?
Exactly.
And there's no... Yeah. Storage on there. There's no battery or
no,
fuel cell.
There's no battery.
Hydrogen
yeah,
little tank.
Nothing. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was exciting. And one guy whose partner is away for a few weeks, he actually has the straightest, best running car.
Uh-huh.
And it's just wonderful to see because he's this quiet student who's English as a second language student or ELL student. And he is like barely communicates to anyone with anyone, you know, verbally, but he's excited.
Right. So this is going to be his thing. Yeah. Do you know what kind of competitions you're going to be facing?
So, no, I don't, because this is a different type of competition. You don't actually take the kids to the competition. You upload videos of your car running
uh-huh.
and an overview of what you built and how you modified it to get the car running the distance.
Okay. Oh, that's right. You guys got like a kit that then you have to come up with
right.
your own mods.
And I should say this is done through Carolina Biological.
Ah.
It's their STEM competition, and they offered it statewide this year, which
cool.
was very nice.
And so... is there any particular, I don't know, like goals that you have to reach or I don't know, hurdles you have to cross that part of the, is it totally open-ended? Like
it's totally open-ended.
So you come up with something cool.
Yeah.
And
you
we'll
have
decide
to,
who's got the coolest.
Right. And we have to stay true to the solar panel that they sent us
okay.
and the motor and anything beyond that.
You
spare
do.
Game.
Okay.
Yeah.
So size doesn't...
No.
No size restriction?
No size restriction.
So, and you guys have to take some videos showing...
Right.
You really... So everything's about... Well, not everything, but a lot's going to be about the video.
Right. So that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to videotape and upload at lunch so that we had some video
uh-huh.
to put together. And I've... videotape them talking a bit.
Uh-huh.
And so.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully they'll all come together on next week. I would like everything sent away by Wednesday.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Wednesday next week.
Yeah.
Well, you have them running at least. So.
Yeah.
Is it 5 separate teams?
Yeah, there's five separate teams.
So each one has their own car.
Yeah. I have a girl team.
Uh-huh.
I have and four boy teams.
Okay.
Yeah. And the girl team, theirs ran probably the shortest amount of time because the motor popped off right after they got on there. But I think that they're going to have a good little car, so it'll be fun to see what happens.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
So what else do you have?
Okay. And the next thing I have is, oh, the Cube satellites. So I got really excited about Planet Labs, even mm-hmm. though I couldn't remember the name of Planet Labs all week as I tried to look it up. And it's this neat little group.
So I think before we talk about Planet Labs, we have to talk about what CubeSats
okay.
are. Okay. Did we talk about CubeSats?
We haven't.
Okay.
So how about you go over CubeSats and I'll go over Planet Labs.
Well, I wasn't expecting to go over it, so I don't remember much. But I do remember that they're 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that the width and the height, the width and the depth have to be 10 centimeters, but the length
right.
can be multiples because
right.
it looks when I see pictures of them that, anyway, and the whole idea is that it takes millions of dollars to get satellites into space, and they're huge, multi-ton, gigantic things, but there's space left over.
Right.
And if you can have a system that a particular form factor that stays constant, where you can put these tiny little satellites, they can piggyback on the major launches,
right.
and it makes it. I mean, I think it's still. Are we talking about millions of dollars to launch? No, hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
Right.
$400,000 to launch one of these CubeSats.
Oh,
or
okay.
Even less.
No, it's much less.
Much
so
less.
I hope I'm not.
Well, so there's okay.
So
here's the trick.
There's two different things going.
There's the cost yeah. that you're going to have to pay right up for launch, and then you also have to build it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And one source, and I have not seen a lot of sources, but it seemed like it was something that was under 200,000,
yeah.
and maybe around.
But that's believable.
Yeah, 150, which I was really excited about because that suddenly opens the field to college students and the kind of grants they can get to build things.
Yeah, definitely.
Notice I did give Luke a big hint about that.
I know.
So
he seemed pretty excited.
He did. Yeah. And I think it would be cool. So what's happening is this one group, which is called Planet Labs, they're actually getting their little CubeSats launched from the International Space Station.
I think they're sending them up all the time.
Yeah.
Like all different rockets.
Yeah.
I'm not
so
sure it's always the International
it's
Space Station.
It's not always there, but that's one place.
That's one of the places.
And it's this neat group that started out in a garage and now is building small satellites for monitoring the Earth's surface. And their goal is to monitor it and to share the data for humanitarian purposes.
Yeah, I think their plan is to have enough satellites. I mean, they have more than 70 satellites up there, I think.
Right.
And I think their plan is to re-image the Earth the entire Earth every 24 hours.
Right.
I don't remember. All of their satellites, I think, are in a single orbit, just
yeah.
one behind the other.
Right.
And the kind of orbit is such that, it's got a strange name, I don't remember it, but it's such that one limb of the orbit is always going between the Earth and the Sun as the
mm-hmm.
Earth rotates, and the other one, of course, on the dark side.
Right.
And so as they pass in between the Sun and the Earth, they're pointing at the Earth, and they just image
mm-hmm.
continuously, and it's one coming after the other. So
right.
it's a little bit like a raster, continuously
right.
scanning the Earth
mm-hmm.
line after line, continuously going and continuously downloading the stuff.
Right.
But the amazing thing about these CubeSats and the Planet Lab system, but everybody using CubeSats, is that you can you can really send up a lot of stuff if you've got the money.
Right.
And which means that you don't have to test it as much, because if it's a lot cheaper to send something up into space, suddenly you don't have to spend so much money on testing it, because if it breaks down, well, then, you know, it wasn't a gigantic loss.
Right. Exactly.
Which means your turnaround goes up, your components become cheaper, and you send stuff up to see what happens, right? So you learn a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a fantastic system.
It is. And it's just a really neat, I think, little company that started up. And something that you should check out, because Planet Labs has a lot of different things that they're offering right now.
Yep. Okay, Planet Labs, CubeSats, what else?
And finally, the new Pi.
The new Pi has arrived.
The new Pi
at the makerspace.
Well,
how many Pis?
No, it hasn't. It's arrived on the shelves that are all back ordered, and we don't have one.
So it's not in class yet. So it has arrived.
It has arrived.
It's on its way. Yeah. No, for real this time.
Yeah. So we won't be working with the Pis actually until you come in on the 21st. So
okay.
Because all of our snow days canceled out, all of our enrichment days.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And that's.
So that's all your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mine is going to be a little bit haphazard because I didn't make a list this time. There was just so much stuff and I just kept going.
Just a moment. I just want to say that you did demand that I make a list early in the week, and you made sure that you're like, now you're taking time to write that list. Did you write that list?
Oh, be quiet.
I'm just saying.
Okay. Touché. Anyway, so first our usual, we should have a news section, our usual news, the Debian RC bug report. This week was really cool because for the first time, the release critical bug count for the next release dropped below 100.
Mm-hmm.
I think it dropped as low as 94 on one of the days. And then it popped back up, but we're getting close. So what an exciting time for all those people, I'm sure. What else? Maybe we should talk about Falls Lake.
Yeah, that was number 16.
That was number 16? What's number 16?
We removed it, remember? It was the one close to the road where we're like, we're removing number 60. It's not needed.
Yeah. But, you know, it should be about future plans, I suppose.
Yes.
But,
man, this has been an ongoing future plan.
We went off Saturday.
We did.
Which was really cool because mm-hmm. we were going to totally get it finished. There was
done.
No question about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we had an O-meet Sunday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to go off Saturday morning again.
I know.
So, but that time, that was it, because we were done. And then, now we have to go out one more time to remove one of, it's not actually, we don't really need to.
No.
Because it's not moving a flag. It's just one of the controls has a flag and we're not going to put anything there.
Right.
So we have to go by and take it off.
Yeah.
But I think we're done. The course mm-hmm. looks good.
Yeah.
I'm pretty happy with it.
I am too. So. I want to go back and go through the course together so that we can have the course notes and really make sure that their cards are accurately marked.
Yeah. Anyway, so there was tons of interesting stuff in the news.
Yep. Oh, and before we go on, thank you, Ian, for all the help that you're giving us, even though it's about to start this weekend in full force.
Yeah, we're going to need his help. So I don't know, do you want some computer stuff or sciencey stuff first? Do we do the tech
sciencey
or
stuff?
The sciencey
first.
Stuff. So the older stuff, one of the really cool things happening is the Dawn spacecraft finally arrived, in quotes, around at Ceres, mm-hmm. our largest asteroid of the asteroid belt. I don't know if it's the largest asteroid in the whole solar system. I thought it was, but then...
It's not.
It's not. Okay.
I don't know. I'm asking. I didn't
know. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
It's definitely the largest of the asteroid belt by far.
Okay.
And the Dawn probe is really cool in that it's has one of those ion drives. So it's a little bit like a magnetic cannon is the way I think about it. It creates ions, mm-hmm. and then the magnetic field shoots out the ion, which is heavy, mm-hmm. right, away from the spacecraft, exactly down an axis that goes through the center of gravity, I suppose. And that's what pushes the spacecraft. And the thrust is extremely low, mm-hmm. but it's way more efficient than a chemical rocket. Okay. And so they can leave it on for, I think they can leave it on for like a third of the mission. It also means that changes in in the velocity vector are going to happen extremely slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So it arrived at Ceres. The orbit is going to be changing. I don't know arrived exactly what that means. They have wheels that they use to reorient the spacecraft.
Oh,
and
cool.
I guess those, well, the thing is, they started to break down the whole mm-hmm. mechanism. And so they shut them off and they're using up, they also have some hydrazine on mm-hmm. board. And they're using that to turn the satellite. So it's interesting. The way I understand it, the ion drive is still powering the thrust, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's highly efficient.
Right.
They have hydrazine on board, and they're using that to quickly turn the satellite towards Earth to send data and then turn it back away again for the correct orientation mm-hmm. for the ion drive to keep working. And when you think about it, if you're going to use a chemical rocket to turn the satellite, you're going to need very little thrust, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a rotational motion. It's not changing the velocity vector.
Right.
So I don't know what it means that it arrived. I mean, it's going to be very slow. Oh, what does it say?
It says
950 kilometers. What's that? Is that how close it is?
I think so.
Wow.
Okay.
That's really close.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was surprised.
And they think there might be water, liquid water underneath.
That's what I was, thinking liner. Was really cool.
Yeah. That came out, let me see, it was the February 20th issue of Science. They had some images in their mm-hmm. news section of taken by Dawn
right.
As it approached Ceres, and they had white spots that they could see when they were 80,000 kilometers away. I'm looking at the article. And what's special about these images is that it's the first time we have images of Ceres that are a higher resolution than we've ever had before. And the ones before that, of course, would be Hubble. And these spots weren't there before. And the idea is, wow, maybe this is actually water, frozen water that's been exposed by meteorite impacts, or maybe gushes of water coming through the surface. I don't know about that, actually.
Oh, neat. The other thing about this, which is kind of cool, and this goes back to the manufacturer of the spacecraft,
uh-huh.
it actually was put together by a group that manufactured it for no profit.
Huh.
They wanted to, and they did it in order to gain experience in a new market.
Orbital Sciences Corporation.
Yeah, Orbital Science. It's just kind of neat to think of them doing. And of course, you know, the project started with a projection of $373 million to build it.
Uh-huh.
And the overall cost when they're done is $446 million. And uh-huh. the only reason I giggle is I think of From Earth to the Moon, and the guy's like, we're over budget again, putting the ball up against the wall.
Yeah, it's like $1 billion. Do you remember when $1 million seemed
like
a lot?
A lot.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, just from the the science article, I just saw 950 kilometers. That's the diameter of Ceres.
The diameter. Okay, yeah, sorry. That's pardon not me. The, Yeah.
Anyway, so that's all exciting. Mm-hmm. And so I will go into another piece of science, because also there's a mission to Europa. And I don't know the I don't know if it's been launched at all, or is it going to arrive? But the idea is that there might be water on Europa also.
Neat.
Because of these plumes. Anyway, so I don't know that as much about that. I think it's just a planning. It's still in the planning phases.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, okay, I'm trying to remember. People got really excited because one of these probes saw plumes, and the surface of Europa is really cracked.
Right.
Or it's not cracked, but it has all these stripes on it that look like they're overlaid, like if water flowed on there. And they think that it's being stretched and compressed by the tidal forces that it's experiencing. And they saw these plumes in profile, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was like, okay, we're going to launch a probe, and it's going to take years and years to get over there, and then it's going to fly through that, and then it's going to pick up some of this stuff. And if these plumes of water are being thrown up because of pressure pushing up liquid water from an ocean that's underneath, you know, inside the planet,
right?
Then if there's life down there, then molecules will be thrown up with the water, and the spacecraft will collect them, and then we'll be able to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big thing was that people have been really looking for those plumes since the first discovery, mm-hmm. and they haven't seen them at all.
Oh, wow.
So it's not like, it's not an interesting place to go. There's all sorts of other stuff, but I think there's a big debate happening right now about what should we be really looking for? Because you only have so many instruments you can put on board. And
mm-hmm.
and the way I understand it is collecting these water molecules is kind of tough, because the probe's going to be flying by extremely fast. And if you just try to collect them without being careful, actually, I remember the article saying that it would destroy the molecules. And when I first read it, I'm like, really? This is a molecule. I mean, how hard can you hit it? But I think it has to do with heat.
Okay.
Right? Because if you hit something hard enough, you generate heat.
Right.
And so they're wanting to create one of those hydrogels
mm-hmm.
to collect stuff and decelerate mm-hmm. it slowly.
And I did find the initial altitude.
For the orbit
yeah.
around Ceres of the Dawn?
Yeah.
13,500 kilometers.
And then okay. they'll bring it down to 5,000. 430.
Gotcha.
And then again to 1,480.
Right.
Yeah. So it'll be neat. We'll have images from different...
Yeah.
Different levels. Different altitudes.
Yeah.
So very interesting stuff.
Anyway, that's all about the Europa thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have your choice now. So that was Europa. There's a really cool one on naming animals.
I don't want that one. No, you don't want I'm that joking. One? You just said really cool. Yeah, let's go for
well,
it.
Well, I think you remember talking about this one. And then there's one you don't know about having to do with contaminated cell lines.
Mm-hmm.
The naming animals
yeah,
one.
Yeah, naming animals.
I think if you don't remember, I'll just say T4. Do you remember
T4? Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
T4 supposedly was this monkey. So this is from the February 27th issue of Science again.
Mm-hmm.
And the article was about the practice of naming research animals, like animals you're going to mm-hmm. use in the lab and giving them, you know, we're not talking scientific names. We're talking mm-hmm. about, you know,
right.
naming a rat George or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, I've always been... I wouldn't say taught, but just I've always had the feeling talking to other people that use animals a lot, which, you know, mm-hmm. I don't. That no, you don't want to do that because you don't want to bias research and so on and so forth. And it's just not professional. But this article was saying there's really two camps. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of people believe, no, naming animals is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And their idea is that, well, they're in stressful environments, being, you know, handled in cages by people. It's not normal, and they get stressed out, and then your results are going to be messed up because mm-hmm. you're studying animals that are continuously stressed out.
Right.
But they were really good pointing out that, you know, people on both sides have absolutely no evidence for what they're saying. There's mm-hmm. no research actually being done. It's still an unknown. And I can see both sides easily. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know how you can ever think that an animal being kept in a lab is anything like normal.
Right.
All the way from the types of pathogens it's exposed to, you know, the type of food it gets, the stresses, right. and...
The care, even.
The care.
It's not that the care is bad care, it's just not the same as welcoming your little dog when you come home.
Well, no, I mean more like versus what the natural state for an animal would be.
Oh, got it.
Right? Yeah. Because definitely. Animals are adapted to a certain lifestyle. And, on the other hand, you know, it's really handy to be able to control everything. Because maybe it's not their, you know, what they're adapted to, but you control variability that mm-hmm. way. So anyway, but it was so funny. They had this one part about this one monkey that someone had. Well, so I guess in this lab they were naming monkeys, mm-hmm. and this one, they tried different names with him, but he was so mean all the time. Nothing stuck, and they like used nasty names for him at some points, but even those didn't stuck, and finally they just named him T4 because that's what the letter T and the number 4 were tattooed on his chest. It's like, that reminded me of our bird.
I know.
Our bird Basil. He is so mean.
He's an adopted bird, and we just haven't calmed the rage within yet.
I think it's gotten worse.
I think it has. But the problem is he has bonded with our sons who have left him and made him even angrier. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Anyway, let's see. What are we? Ah, we're going up to like 15 minutes in the podcast.
Okay.
I will go on to this one interesting thing. It's about cell lines. So mm-hmm. cell lines, you know, you collect a biological tissue that has particular characteristics mm-hmm. and you make the cells immortal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's called transforming them. Right. So they're basically cancer cells, right? But you hope that they retain a lot of the characteristics of the original tissue. And the reason that this is done and why it's so important is that you want to be able to have a supply of cells that you can document over many labs, how they function, mm-hmm. what their physiology is, and use them as a model. And if the cells are constantly changing, it's a lot harder to do that. But once the cells are transformed, they will replicate forever. And so the idea is that, well, once you have a cell line established like this, you replicate them for your use, and then you freeze the others, and then other researchers want some, you send them some, they replicate them, they freeze down some, and everybody ends up with all these cells. And I guess there's been a problem with this entire system, and this is like the second or third time that I've seen really strong articles written about people that are trying to show how bad of a problem this is. This particular article was about Christopher Korch, K-O-R-C-H. He's at the University of Colorado. Mm-hmm. And but in the article, you can see he's in a long line of scientists that are trying to make a point that we have a really serious problem in science, that many of these cell lines are not what we think they are. So a perfect example is some of how this can happen is you handle cells, right? Mm-hmm. And your cells might be, they might somehow be contaminated through handling different dishes and stuff with some other cells. And these other cells, and the typical one here is the HeLa cells, mm-hmm. for, I think, is that breast cancer, HeLa?
I don't know, or check.
Uterine cancer, I can't remember. Those cells are extremely aggressive. Mm-hmm. And so then you end up with 90% of the cell line you're interested in and 10% of this other that contaminated it. But after you replicate the cells through a few passages, suddenly they're all HeLa cells, but you still think they're the other cells.
Cervical cancer.
Cervical. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah. And the number of cell lines that are actually have been completely replaced by a different cell type is really just staggering. And the problem, of course, is that people ask for the cells, they freeze some, and then they use some in their research, but they take it for granted that what they ask for is what they're getting, and they are not testing it. And what these people are saying is, you really have to test every single cell line you get before you do your research. For some stuff, it doesn't matter, right? You're looking for a particular mechanism, and you do your experiments on the cells, and you say, okay, this is how cells respond. But if you're interested in how kidney cells respond to a particular insult, mm-hmm. and you compare kidney cells to liver cells, to HeLa cells, mm-hmm. and it turns out all of them are HeLa cells, then your publication is basically nonsense.
Right. Exactly.
What I found really strange is that a lot of scientists just don't want to accept that they've been doing a lot of research and it looks like their cell lines were not what they thought. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could really hurt, right?
Yeah.
But they have responses where they come back and say, but the cells look totally different. And, you know, I can understand how the same cell, like a HeLa mm-hmm. cell, might look different under different conditions. I don't understand how three sets of HeLa cells that you think are different cells, but are cultured in exactly the same way, all end up looking totally different.
Right.
It seems kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's a big deal. Hmm. So.
That's interesting.
Yep. A problem in science. Mm-hmm. Okay. Move on to you want to wrap it up now?
Well, yeah, I think for the time.
Okay, then we will wrap it up. Future plans?
Mm-hmm. Future plans.
Well, so we kind of talked a bit about it. I mean, everything is being taken up right now by the makerspace at your school and the O-Meet coming up on March 22nd. Mm-hmm. And until that O-Meet is done, we're basically not going to be doing anything.
We have no life.
No, we have no life. So that's all of our future plans.
Yeah, that's everything in a nutshell.
the OSH Park boards with the 80 mega testing and all that, that's just been put aside.
But soon to come out. In another two weeks.
The web hosting site for the whole Frontal Harvest system website, that's being put off for a bit. Yes, it will arrive someday.
It will.
Anyway. But, okay, so that's it. So thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
Make sure you check out the blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.